Hey, gang, do you find yourself listening to your music on one app and then listening to your podcast on another app? If you do, stop this insane behavior right now and download Spotify. Spotify is home to all of your favorite music and all of your favorite podcasts. Podcasts including Fly on the Wall, the Saturday Night Live podcast with Dana Carvey and David Spade, the Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt, old favorites like Fresh Air, My Favorite Murder, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Look, if you're looking for a news podcast or sports or entertainment or true crime, look, if you're looking for a sewing podcast or an RV podcast, Spotify has all of this for you. That's Spotify. All of your favorite music and all of your favorite podcasts in one place. Find it in your app store and start listening today. That's Spotify, music and podcasts. Let's get down. Attention, Austin guitar players and bass players. Are you in need of setup or repair on your axe? Well, I have the guy for you, gang. That's Jason Swedberg over at J. Scott Luthery, and you can find him at J. Scott Luthery on Instagram. Now, if you listen to the show, you know I've been talking about Jason for years. Why is that? Because I've been taking my guitars to Jason for over 20 years. Not only does he do the best job, but he has the best prices and the fastest service in town. Again, find him at J. Scott Luthery on Instagram. Not only is he doing an amazing job repairing and setting up guitars, he is now building guitars. That's right. He built me an SG Junior, which I have, and it sounds amazing. It feels great. It's the very first SG Junior he ever built. I've got a J. Scott Luthery SG Junior. You can go see him at J. Scott Luthery on Instagram. Get a guitar built. Get your guitars fixed. Get them set up. J. Scott Luthery on Instagram. Let's get down.
Open my vault?
Open your vault.
Once I open the vault, it ceases to be a vault.
You have no choice.
Leave the vault.
Johnny, I'm your host, and welcome to another episode of How Did I Get Here from the Vault, where we reach back into our vault of over 1,000 episodes, pull one out, shine it up, and re-release it for you just in case you missed it or in case you want to hear it again. Today, we are going all the way back to October of 2013 to episode 213, and we talk to Adrian Quesada from Black Pumas. But gang, this is before Black Pumas. This is before Boleros Psicodélicos. This is before his latest album, Jaguar. Yeah, man. This was right when he was leaving Grupo Fantasma, and he was doing some brownout stuff, and he was doing some Money Chicha stuff, but he was starting to produce a lot of people. And I'd heard about him from my friend Ian Moore. I'd heard about him from my friend David Garza. I'd heard about him from Jazz Mills and Susanna Schaffel. All these people were singing his praises for a couple years before I actually met him. Everyone was working with him in the studio. I knew who he was. I'd seen Grupo Fantasma. I thought they were amazing. I hadn't seen Brownout yet, I don't think. Anyway, so I got asked to do this Elliott Smith tribute in like September of 2013. And Adrian was on that gig. He was like the house band guitar player for this Elliott Smith tribute show. And I was singing a couple songs. So I ended up getting to know him during the rehearsals and during the hanging out before the show and the sound checks and all that stuff. And I invited him on the show. And he was just doing a record, Echocentrics. As I said, he had just left Grupo Fantasma. Basically, we hit it off at the Elliott Smith tribute, and I asked him to come by and be on the show, and we talked about Grupo Fantasma, the Echocentric, which he was doing at the time, Brownout, playing with Prince, talking about Prince, producing records, growing up a punk skater kid in Laredo, going to Golden Globe parties, Grammys, missing a Grammy Awards in a truck stop, making it to a Grammy Awards. Great stories, great conversation from a long time ago, pre-Black Pumas, pre-Boleros Psicodélicos and Jaguar. This is me and my friend, Adrian Quesada, from episode 213 in October of 2013. Let's get down.
Oh,
three of them. Look, I have the rack mount, and then I have the old school one underneath there, and then I have that little pocket one. Yeah. What do you think of those things? I mean, how much do you use as a producer? How much would you use a...
The pot?
Yeah, or like a Sans amp or something like that.
Well, it's like I record on Logic, and Logic has the same thing in the program. So, like, this is kind of... To me, I just use whatever's on Logic now. I'm so used to that. But I used to use the shit out of that one.
Out of the...
I carry that all the time.
The main pod, yeah.
When I'd go to studios and stuff, because people always wanted me to switch it up really quick, and it's like... It was super cool.
You're a guitar player.
Yeah.
What? How many bands do you play guitar in right now? Just one or two?
Are we starting?
Yeah.
Oh, shit. Okay. Snuck up on me, man.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Having tech talk.
Sneaky,
okay.
Sneaky.
How many bands do I play guitar in right now? Like active bands, I'd say one, two, three.
Name these bands.
Brownout.
Okay. And that's been around for a while.
Yeah.
How long?
Nine, 10 years. Okay. And that was an offshoot of Grupo Fantasma, which I just left that band, was in that band for 13 years.
And that band still goes on?
Yeah, they're still playing.
You were a founder of Grupo Fantasma?
Mm-hmm. I was the founding member.
Okay, go ahead. So
I still play with Brownout, which is the same guys, essentially. So, you know, it feels weird.
What made you leave one and stay with the other if it's the same guy? It's obviously not the guys.
It's a lot of... Grupo was a big commitment. Yeah. You know, those guys are crazy. They will not stop, and they're just going forward. And I wanted to have time to do other stuff. I wanted time to like be a producer. I wanted time. I always felt like I was scattered and spread too thin. And then when I was doing Grupo stuff, I didn't have the I wasn't even all the way there. Or this was in the last 5 years, because early on that was like my big commitment. But I wanted the time to do other stuff. I wanted a little more time with my family. They tour nonstop. And I felt like even when I was there, it was I wasn't all the way there. I wasn't really focused, and like I was just kind of going through the motions, and it just started to feel weird. And I wanted more control of my schedule. I wanted freedom to do other stuff, produce records, and you know, work on other projects and stuff. So I still play with Brownout, which is the same guy. So it's kind of like nothing's changed. I still hang out with the dudes all the time. I still hear all the Grupo news and you know, get the word on that world. And then we have a smaller band that plays cumbia stuff called Money Chicha, and it really just started as like a cover band that we'd do for fun. Originally, the Continental Gallery asked us to put something together a couple years ago, and we did that just as a way to just kind of play some gigs, make some money, and you know, not just recently we started taking it a little more seriously.
How big is that band?
Anywhere between 4 and 6. And that was the idea. Was like, actually, the idea was to do it as small as 3, but to have a band where the reason it was called Money Chicha was because Continental Gallery Steve Wertheimer wrote me and asked me to put something together. And we were like, well, how the hell are we going to make any money at the gallery? You've been to the gallery,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I've always wondered. How do you make money at the gallery?
See, people make money somehow. You know, if they pack it, they get a good percentage of the bar.
So Tamika does just make a good...
From what I hear, yeah.
It's obviously, because there are shows that have cover. I did a show there with John D. Graham. I did two of them, where you go and play along with him.
Mm-hmm.
And he... It's called John D and Friends or something. And I got a lot of money. I mean, more than I was like, really? At the end of that thing.
I think it's sliding scale. I think Steve kicks cash when he thinks it's worth it or something. So we were trying to figure out how to make money. And we were like, we can't do like an 8-piece band there. We're just not going to make anything. It's not going to be worth it. So we kind of sent an email around trying to like brainstorm. And one of them, Chicha is a kind of cumbia music from Peru that was like in the late 60s and early 70s. Peruvian teenagers that were into like the Ventures and surf guitar, like surf rock stuff,
yeah,
started doing cumbia music, like, but as if they were pretending to be the Ventures. So like they did this cool like surf guitar version of Latin music,
yeah,
and that's called chicha music because that's like the liquor that they drink down there. So we thought, well, what if we did that, because we were really into that stuff and we were learning those covers for fun. And we just said, well, so the email said had a dollar sign. Because it was like, how do we make money? So it's a dollar, and then it's a chicha. And then when we were trying to come up with a name, we were like, Money Chicha, there it is. So we still do that project. I still play with the same guys.
You guys play at the gallery every week?
No, we never did it, actually. It's funny, because by the time we got it together, Steve was like, sorry, book somebody else. So like it kind of turned into something else. So
that's funny.
So because of Steve, we do have another band. And then a couple of recording projects, one that's with a friend of mine from New York called Ocote Soul Sounds, and we have put out 4 records, I believe, and we've toured a little bit here and there, but we neither of us have, like, you know, the intention to make it a band that's, like, performing. It's just kind of a studio project, and when we put out a record, we'll play some shows, whatever.
Like up in New York and down here or something?
Yeah, and we've done a couple of tours. And then I have a project that was kind of the closest thing I've done to a solo project called The Echocentrics. And that was just a bunch of songs that I wrote. I'm not a singer, and I'm not a lyricist.
Is that the one that you sent me with the girls singing?
Yeah, yeah. That's so I got a couple of girl singers, friends of mine, to sing on it, and we did some shows. But that band doesn't. It's really hard to kind of get it together and play. And I don't want to be spread too thin and playing with 100 bands. However, I do have another band with a friend of mine named Dante Schwebel. He was in a band called Hacienda, and he actually went to my high school. He's from my hometown. And Patrick Hallahan, the drummer from My Morning Jacket, and I got together, and we did this, just, you know, for lack of a better way to describe it, I think the easiest way is to say a cool, like, rock and roll record. And we did that. We've been working on that for about a year. We just finished it earlier this year, and it comes out in March of 2014. And that we will be doing as a live band, actual band, you know, because I have a million recording projects, so people are always, like, thinking I like to just start bands just to start bands, but I just like to, I get restless, and basically came out of, like, before people started asking me to produce their records, I would just make the record that I wanted to make for somebody else. I'd like the Echocentrics thing. I was writing all these songs, I probably had 40 of them laying around, and I wanted to do something, you know, feminine. I was coming from, like, at the time playing with Grupo a lot and Brownout, and it's just like this massive, like, adrenaline testosterone sound with, like, big horns and everything, and I was like, I just want to do something kind of feminine and with a feminine touch, you know. It was like,
So
female singers, and you know, Natalia and Cheetah, who sang on the record, they're from Argentina and Brazil. They helped me, you know, write all the lyrics and handle all the vocal duties. So, like, that project in particular came out of my need to, like, I was like, God, I wish a female singer would ask me to produce her record, and then I was like, well, I'll just make my own record. And
yeah,
then, you know. So just in the last couple of years, I've been working on other people's records, which was. So now I'm like,
it's just in the last couple of years that I've started hearing your name. I think I first heard it from David and Susanna.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've done stuff.
Are we
going
to Adrian Casales?
Yeah, yeah.
Who's that? That sounds like a fucking dance producer, doesn't it? Sounds like a guy that just remixed your dance.
Maybe
thing.
It does. Yeah. Yeah.
So. How did people start asking you? Who was the first person that you started working with?
I think the first band that I did, the first records I officially produced were the last two Grupo Fantasma records.
Okay.
Those were, you know, I'd kind of been, back then I didn't really know, we always did our own stuff, and I didn't know really that I was already producing it. It was like, I was kind of doing it anyways, and then it just hit me. I was like, I need to get the credit for this. Like, I'm producing the record. So I produced the last two records that got Grammy nominations. One won a Grammy, and two. So that was the first stuff I actually did, but it was my own band. So, like, I wouldn't learn what it really
meant. How gratifying, though, is that? You know what I mean?
It's pretty crazy.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
you finally got your name on the record because you were doing the work anyway. Where were you guys recording? Were you working, like, with an engineer? Were you?
The first record that got that I produced for Grupo was done at Wire Recording. Do you know Stuart Sullivan?
Of course. It's gone. Yeah. I just noticed the other day I was driving down. It's like some kind of fucking pawn shop.
Yeah, yeah. He moved. It's right down the street.
I made a record there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But not when I did it when it was Andy Taub's place.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So go ahead. Sorry.
That was back in the day. Yeah, yeah. So he moved now, like, down the street. So Stuart had recorded a couple of things for us, and he recorded that record. And then for the next one, we didn't really have money, and we rented a house and just built our own studio. And me and our sound man and tour manager engineered the whole record. And it was a
Who's that?
Freaking nightmare. His name's Brendan Burke. He works. He's on tour with The Sword right now. He's their tour manager.
Oh, cool.
They snatched him up from us. Those metal guys.
I love The Sword. You
like
them?
Yeah, they're awesome. Yeah,
they're
super rad, man. Yeah. So yeah, they stole him from us. But yeah, me and him engineered it. And then after that, the first band that actually asked me to produce their record was... See, I always thought you just kind of like...
Wait, what did you win the Grammy for?
The Grupo record.
I know, but what was the category? Best Latin?
They combined like 4 Latin categories. So it was like best Latin rock... urban or alternative, like super stupid. Like, There used to be like three Latin categories, and then they like just started every year they get smaller, and then they just put them all into one category. So
why can't we just go back to the days of Ricky Martin when the Latin explosion was happening?
Exactly.
I knew then that, I mean, I'm Cuban, you're Latin, guys like David, guys like Vallejo, all these guys, I was like, guys, we got 45 minutes to capitalize on our heritage, because it's going to go away and it's not going to be that big of a deal.
Well, it's funny because the number, like, for everything you hear is like, you know, it's like Latinos are like the fastest growing population, and pretty much probably is apparently going to outnumber.
I think we outnumber white people
already. Yeah. But it's, you don't see those numbers. It just doesn't add up.
So was it a Grammy that was presented at the show? Did you get to, were you on TV?
No, I didn't go that year. I went the first year that we got nominated and didn't win.
Why didn't you go the second year?
It's a long story, but okay. The first year, no, they do. There's like, I don't know, a couple hundred or a few hundred categories. They only televise like 15. They only televise like rap, you know, rock, the main ones. But like all the other ones, like the classical and
jazz,
polka,
folk,
whatever, all that. Those are actually done in the ceremony before the televised part in a smaller, like, or a big ballroom, but it's not like as glamorous as it is on TV. However, they did give us tickets, so I did go to that. But the first year, I swore we were going to win. I mean, we went in there and I had a speech and I was just like, and we didn't win. The next year, they gave us four tickets. For a 10-piece band with like crew and everything. It was super lame and it was kind of annoying, and they would not budge on that, because the first year they gave us all tickets, and then we also had the option to buy girlfriends or wives extra tickets. So like we all took our wives and girlfriends, and super fun night, you know, we got to see like the televised part, which is a spectacle. If you know, I feel like
it's not boring.
No, it was actually pretty fun. Okay. It's kind of fun because it's just whatever, you know.
Yeah,
you're at the Grammys, whatever.
Yeah.
But wasn't something I'd want to go to every year. I think it was just one of those bucket list.
You went to the Grammys.
Yeah. And the next time they offered us four tickets, and we were like, all right, so this is a 10-piece band, and they wouldn't budge. So it was like, so here we are, like all fighting for four tickets. At that point, I didn't think we were going to win. I really didn't. I just totally didn't think we were going to win. And I was just kind of jaded by the whole thing. And it was just like, whatever. I'll opt out of this. You guys can fight for the tickets. And eventually, actually, it was funny because it ended up that one ticket just went to waste. We ended up with just three people going to the Grammys. So we drove up there, booked some shows on the way up to just kind of pay for it, and played the night before in LA and turned around and just drove home. But we stopped at a truck stop to, because you could stream the Grammys or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we just totally thought, it was funny because the night before we were leaving and we were all kind of drunk, and we stopped at like a Walgreens or something, and I bought a, what's the like shitty champagne that like is in the commercial?
Andre.
No, it's a Korbel, right?
Yeah, Korbel.
So I bought a bottle of Korbel and was like, just in case we win, and it just kind of was funny. We stopped at a truck stop and tried to like stream it. Kind of made this like big scene in there, and like all these truck drivers were around us, and it wasn't really like we couldn't really get the internet connection and stuff. But I was on the phone with my wife, and we were all checking it out, and we had all these truck drivers that were like, they're nominated for a Grammy, and we were like, yeah, we're trying to watch. And I was on the phone with my wife, and we were like, the streaming thing was like super slow and like 4 seconds behind, you know. So they were like about to get to it and whatever. And my wife just goes, "You want a fucking Grammy?" And I was like, "We want a fucking Grammy." It turned into this party at the truck stop. We bought a bunch of beer, and we had a bus at the time. We actually got on the bus, like started drinking beer, and then I was like, "I got Korbel." We like popped a bottle of Korbel. Is it Korbel? I don't know. Anyways, shitty champagne. And then and we had a little party on the bus, and then our bus broke down. No, our bus driver got sick. That's what it was. In Arizona. And like 2 hours later, all of a sudden, he got super sick. So we checked into like the crappiest motel. It was straight out of Breaking Bad. And then he was so sick that he basically like went to pass out and forgot to like turn on, I don't know, whatever, like the AC was off in the bus. It was like the generator wasn't running, and we were all sweating. And then we went in, we got another hotel room so that we could just go somewhere. And we all watched the Grammys from a like crappy fucking meth hotel in Arizona and watched the televised part. And that was it.
Wow.
So yeah, I wasn't there.
That's interesting. I watched the Grammys, not the 2013, but the 2012 Grammys in a shitty motel in Bowling Green, Kentucky, by myself. Driving to Ohio. Yeah,
rock and roll. That's interesting. Life, man.
Yeah. Okay. So tell me more about Grupo Fantasma. Let's how did that band come together? What did you do? Because that was a big band, a significant band. You guys got extreme amount of love from Prince. I remember reading about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fuck. I mean, that's like a, for any guys, I don't know how old you are, but like guys like my age or like David,
mm-hmm.
if Prince was like, oh, this is my band.
It was
hardcore. I would retire.
It was hardcore, man. That's how we felt. We felt pretty like on top of the world for about a little bit there.
That's like Paul McCartney.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying there's only like a couple of guys.
I was just telling somebody yesterday, but they were asking like, what was the biggest thing we took away from Prince? And I think the main thing that it was like the confidence that we got. Like it was like taking a high school football team and throwing them into the NFL because some guy comes and tells you, some guy who you really look up to is like, no, you're this good. Believe me.
And then you go out and you beat the Packers.
Yeah, or like, you at least hang and like, tie the game or lose by seven. So it was like, all of a sudden we're just like, man, we're pretty fucking good. Like, and I have confidence and I'm like a good guitar. And we're like a good band. Everybody felt like, man, we're good. And then like right then was like, that was right when we made that first Grammy nominated record. So everything was just like firing on all cylinders and we just felt awesome. And then like, another thing we, you know, was like, as you know, like I think things about Austin is that it's so like the aesthetic is such a like keep it real, you know, like aesthetic that like a lot of times like the showmanship and stuff like that and stage presence. Yeah, it's just like, you know, it's supposed to be like this authentic place where like some dude looks like he could be your neighbor is just on stage playing guitar. But then you go with Prince and you're opening for Prince where his fans will boo you if they don't like it because they don't give a shit who you are. They want to see Prince. So, and he's putting on this killer show where like everybody's dressed to the nines. He's rocking it and it's just like...
Yeah, they fucking dance and
their attention to detail.
Someone paid money to see them play. They're not going to be your neighbor on the front porch with a fucking guitar singing, you know, you can't always get what you want or something.
So then suddenly like we're in that world where we're like, man, we got to step up our show. Like, you know, we can, I mean, in Austin, we just like are drinking beer and we're just standing there because that's how everybody is in Austin. But then it's like, man, there's a reason that people like that are paying that much money to see them because you're going to see a show. Like if I want to go... And I'll still go to bars and watch some friends of mine just play guitar because I like that too. But if I'm going to drop that much money, you better fucking put on a show. Like, and that was the other thing I think we learned was like, man, we got to step this up because
if you're going to have a 10-piece band like Grupo Fantasma. Mm-hmm. You don't want guys just standing up there with their, you know, just thing. So how did he see you? What happened?
He opened a club in Vegas. He had a Vegas residency.
Yes,
where he took over the Rio was the hotel, and it was called 3121. I think he took it over for about a year and a half. And our manager at the time was old friends with a dude who worked for Prince. Prince never really had like a manager, like one manager. He just has a bunch of people around.
It's organized all very strange.
Chaos. It's just basically a bunch of people waiting for him to say something. And when he does it, they just make it happen. I mean, if he's just like, hey, I want the space shuttle here in 5 minutes to pick me up, they'll figure out how to get the fucking space shuttle.
Yeah.
So... we knew somebody who worked for him, and the word got to us that Prince had opened this club, and he had a, every night was like a theme, and there was Latin night on Thursday, and they asked us to send him a CD, and we did, and that was it, and we were like, okay, we just thought it was stupid, we were like, I'm so sure Prince is actually going to listen to our record, just sounds ridiculous, but sure, we'll entertain this. We sent it off, we didn't hear anything for a long time, and then suddenly, we got like everything's like this big deal where it was like a message that Prince is going to hear your record tomorrow. You know, like
this
it was
exactly
scheduled.
Like the stories that I hear. Sorry, go ahead.
So it was like scheduled, like, you know, Prince, tell them I'm going to put this CD in my CD player tomorrow. So that's like what we got back to us. It's like Prince is listening to our record tomorrow. A couple months later, we were like, okay, whatever. And then it's like Prince liked the CD. He's going to hear it again, you know, that kind of thing. And like, so we were like, okay. And then we didn't hear anything. And then it turned out that the band that he had on Thursdays didn't want to do Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving was on a Thursday that year. And then so they called us, the B team, and they were just like, well, we have this band canceled. Nobody wants to play Thanksgiving. And we were like, we'll fucking play Thanksgiving, whatever. They flew us over there, picked us up in limos, like all this stuff. And we played the gig, and we never saw him. Until like the very end of the night. We just thought he was going to actually come talk to us, but we didn't know what we were getting into until, you know, we'd know him much later. But he like actually watched the show from like the shadows in the corner on the stage without saying anything to us. And then we finally saw him and we're like, oh shit. And we were waiting in our green room for him after, and he never came. And that was it. He just took off. That's just Prince style. You know, it's always kind of mysterious. It's on his terms. And then the next morning we flew back home, and that was it. It was Thanksgiving, the day after Thanksgiving. And by the time we got off our plane, that he had actually called and said that he fired the other band and we were the new house band on Thursdays. That's how that started.
So did they fly you out there every Thursday?
Every Thursday morning. It was crazy.
Was it a pack? How many people were in this club? I mean,
not many. I stayed, when we would play, there'd be like, I mean, it probably fit like 1,200 to 1,500 people. But when we played, we would play on Thursdays. On Wednesday nights, he would have like old school night where he would bring in like, you know, like 70s funk guys like Larry Graham or Dougie Fresh, stuff that he liked. Mm-hmm. And then on Fridays and Saturdays, he'd play. I stayed and watched one weekend. I stayed and actually watched his shows, which was awesome to see him with a small room for him.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
And
it's like seeing him in the setting of like the movie Purple Rain.
Yeah, exactly. It was about that size. And he packed it. I mean, he sold it out. With us, it'd be like 100 people, you know, sometimes more, sometimes totally dead. And then we were there every Thursday, probably about 3 or 4 gigs into it. He still hadn't come up and said anything to us. He just jumped on stage and started playing. And then that night we were like, all right, this is the night we meet him. Nope. Nothing. And then
what, let me just ask you a question, because this is a big thing, and there must be something that rushes. I mean, I know myself as a musician, if I saw him out of the corner of my eye jump on stage and start playing guitar, I would fumble a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I'd have, you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It's him.
Yeah, it's surreal.
And when he starts playing, are you like, whoa, does he step on people when he plays at all? Does he come in like owning it?
He owns the shit out of it. But there was, you know, much later we'd end up playing a lot with him. Like we did rehearsals, gigs, we were his backing band a couple of times, we opened for him. We ended up doing a lot. Our relationship really like developed from there. But, you know, we came to find out that, like, I mean, he knows it's about him, we did a couple of gigs where he like was super respectful and like really cool and asked us, like, the first time we actually met him, we had been doing the Vegas thing, but we still hadn't talked to him. And then we got one time we were actually in Vegas. It was the weekend I stayed to watch him, because I stayed and watched Friday and Saturday with my wife and her family. We flew back to Austin and we're at the, I remember it was raining. It was a Sunday,
right?
Yeah, it was a Sunday. It was a Saturday. I think maybe it had been Saturday. Anyways, whatever. That weekend, we were at the library with our daughter, and it was like pouring down, and our manager called and was like, where are you? And I said, I'm at the library. And he goes, how fast can you get to the airport? I was like, not very fast, but I'll do my best. Why? And he was like, Prince wants you guys in LA for something. We don't know what. Everything's paid. Don't worry about it. He's like, get your suit. And I'm like, shit. So like, we all just organized and made it to the airport, and we ended up, it turned out we got to LA. We didn't know what the hell we were doing. Finally got to this hotel, and it turned out he was having a Golden Globes after party, and it was like just a huge, basically a suite, you know, no stage, nothing. It was like the stage was like the corner of a hotel room, literally, like, so imagine, you know, as big as the corner here of your place. And there was, all the instruments were set up, it was like all backline was set up, and we thought we were opening for his band. And we had, at that point, we had become pretty friendly with like his guitar tech, his sound man, a couple other dudes, and we were like asking them, like, because nobody ever knew what the hell was going on. We were like, they were like, we don't know, we just wait for him to come make the call. And we were talking to his sound man, and he was like, I don't think the band is here, I think you guys are the band. And we were like, well, what are we gonna play? Because he didn't tell us to learn anything. And he was like, we were like, we have no idea, but we know that his band is not here, so just wait and see what happens. He finally showed up to like a sound check and set up his stuff and was just like, yeah, so you guys want to play? And we were like, well, yeah, I mean, we're here, so what are we playing? And he was like, just play your songs, I'll just play with you guys. And he was like, that gig was like, he was, you know, humble is a word that I don't know if it ever used in the same sentence with the word Prince, but like humble enough to like be there and be like asking me, like, you know, before songs, like, what key are we in, like, and you know, super like kind of sort of on our level, except he's wearing heels and he's Prince,
right?
And it was nothing but like A-list celebrities in there, and we just played this house party where we were his band. And then that was the first time he actually spoke to us, and then from there we were like a little more comfortable, and then we started doing more stuff. I think we kind of earned his trust, and then suddenly he was like talking to us. So it took him a while. It's, everything is like, you know, all this shit about like don't look him in the eye and all that is was not true at all. But you definitely know that he sets the tone. Like if he doesn't want to talk, he'll walk in and not talk to you, and you don't say shit.
I got that from not recent, but probably around the time whenever he released that triple album, where one of the records was some woman you'd never heard of. You know what I'm talking about?
I remember, but who was the woman?
I can't remember. Mm-hmm. But he was promoting some new person, mm-hmm. which he gets behind and stuff like mm-hmm. that. But in that interview with Tavis Smiley, I was like, wow, he lives in an insular. He lives an insular existence that probably he's lived since 1981.
Yeah, exactly.
And his reality is not the rest of the world mm-hmm. at all. There's no way.
Yeah, yeah, it's his own world for sure.
Yeah. And I was evening with Kevin Smith, that director guy. Mm-hmm. He talks to some stories about Prince having him come out to Paisley Park and just like there was that, hey, Prince is going to call you in 10 minutes.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I love that there's people, there's warm-up people. Yeah. Okay, so, well, that what ultimately, that gave you a huge amount of confidence.
Yeah.
Probably gave a bit of a buzz. Like, then when you went back to LA, did famous people come see you play? Or are you guys like Selma Hayek's?
We never, yeah, exactly. She was there. She actually sat right behind me. She sat right behind me on the keyboard bench.
Really?
Yeah. He set up his keyboard player as well. His keyboard player was there with us at that gig. But yeah, she totally like, I mean, I had J-Lo closer than where you are, which is like 4 feet, 3 feet in front of me at that gig. I mean, standing there. And we had Salma Hayek came by me and sat like right behind me. Just, you know.
Latin music.
Well, explosion. It was everybody. It was like, that was the night Lindsay Lohan like went to rehab the next morning.
Oh, she was at the party?
There. Yeah. They were all at the party. It was absolutely surreal to get thrown into that. Penelope Cruz walked by me. I got a little sniff of her essence, which was amazing. And but you know, it never translated into like us being a celebrity band, but I think the name recognition probably helped with things like the Grammys. Like people were like, oh, those are the guys that play with Prince. Cause to that point we were touring and we were, you know, successful in like a few markets around the country. And we had, I think at that point we had already maybe been to Europe. Maybe not. I think it was like a year later, but,
how did you do in Europe?
We do really well in Europe. Yeah. And the Europeans love the shit. It's so exotic.
How many records did you guys put out while you were in the band?
Let's see. 1, 2, 3, 5.
Okay.
And they have a new one that we did with Steve Berlin from Los Lobos produced it. It was our first time actually working Fantastic. With an outside producer. That hasn't come out yet, but that's done.
Okay. And you're on it?
Yeah.
Okay. What about Brownout?
We have 4.
4?
Yeah.
Did you produce all those?
We actually produced those kind of between 3 of us. That was kind of like our me and the other guitar player and the bass player, Beto and Greg. That's kind of our baby. So we split the production duties kind of between us. The way it worked usually with that band is we were the writers and we basically produced our own songs, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, it wouldn't be until like just the last few years that I realized that producing other bands is a whole other beast from like knowing what you want your stuff to sound like to going out and working with other bands and seeing all the, and just navigating through all the like band weirdness and dramas and chemistry and everything. It's one thing that coming from a 10-piece band, I think like I was able to, you know, adapt pretty well. Cause I'm like, man, I've seen it all. I've seen every bit of chemistry. I've seen every bit of drama. I know like the weirdness when somebody's making a record and somebody's not happy with this and somebody's being sneaky and whatever. And, you know, half of it I think is really just being a diplomat. I remember somebody saying that, who did a lot of records in the 60s and 70s. I've heard like 2 things that were interesting. One was that like, he was like all really just being a diplomat and just making sure like the guitar player who wrote his song, if you can make him happy by maybe getting his song on the record, then he's happy. And then when he comes in to play for other people's shit, other people's songs, he's happy. A lot of it is just that. And then the other part I heard was just like, the other thing I heard that was interesting was like, if the band is comfortable, you've done half the job. You know, I don't know how I would say that half the work is that, but, you know, a lot of it is just making people happy in the studio. Cause you know, there's a lot of weirdness as I'm sure you've experienced.
Especially in a band dynamic.
Totally,
you know,
man.
There's the people that aren't saying stuff mm-hmm. and when the communication, cause people don't want to be like, hey, that's a, you know,
mm-hmm.
it comes off kind of bad to spout your mouth off like that.
Totally. I mean, so it's
people hold shit in, and then it does become like a sneaky and like weird.
I think that like all the Beatles stories are kind of like the archetype, you know, almost like the Shakespeare of band studio stories of hearing, like, you know, George wanted his songs on there, and Paul and John hated fucking Paul's songs, but then John was bringing his girlfriend around, and you know what I mean, like, and that all that stuff, you see it, and it's just like total archetype shit. I'm like, oh yeah, there's the guitar player wants to get his songs on there, and this dude doesn't like this dude, and this dude, whatever. It's like,
and then there's the outside people that are like, you know, you're the best one. I don't know why you have that guy up there singing those songs. Yeah, you should be the guy. You're the guy. You're the main guy.
So I love that shit, man. I've always had a little bit of a diplomatic side. So I like to come in, and it's funny, like when I've worked with bands now, like I can almost, like I said, it's just all like I said, archetypes. Like you're just like, oh, okay, that's the dude that,
one
that's like the really talented one behind the scenes that has all the cool ideas.
Right, this guy's the mouthpiece.
Yeah, exactly.
Without him, no one would know who they were, but without this guy, they wouldn't be any good.
Yeah. This dude is sulking in the corner because he has a lot to say, but he's not going to say it. You know, it's like, this person is that, it's funny. So.
How do you, do people come to you? I mean, do people come to you and are you the kind of person that goes like, you know what, I don't know what I would do with this, but I know this guy over here.
I've just recently had that happen a couple of times where I'm like, you know, I just have to be honest. Like at first I feel like I was just taking on everything because I just wanted to do everything and I wanted experience.
You
and
want
everything.
The experience, and you also need to make a living.
But now just recently I've had to like sincerely tell people, a couple of people, like, you know, I just don't think that I'm like the right person for this. I'll help, you know, I mean, I can mix or engineer and do stuff like that. But as far as overseeing a whole record or really helping you come up with like a concept or a direction, you know, may not be the guy. But luckily everybody I've worked with, I've been super into. Yeah. You know, it's either like I'm really a fan of their music, or I think they're really good people and have good intentions.
Yeah.
Then
you've worked on some stuff with Susanna, right?
Yeah, I've done a couple of tracks with Susanna.
Somebody like that, do you put in songwriting input? Like, oh, you know, this might need a little something here.
Little tiny bit. She's pretty together when she comes in as far as her songs go. But like, she's also open minded enough to just lay down a chord structure and her vocal part and then be open to suggestions and, you know, that I had. And I think that's probably why we've done like one-off things. I haven't done like a whole record for her. But I think she knew when she called me for that stuff was like that I would contribute something that, you know, made sense for the record. So.
Yeah. What about someone like David?
David was an interesting one. Like he has a little bit of a, not in the way that like you said, living in this insular world, but he has this, he's kind of like a prince in that, like, he can play all the shit. That's one thing with Prince, is like when you're playing in a room with him, you know that he can get on your instrument. He can play better than the drummer.
Play his ass off, yeah.
He can play better than the drummer, better than the bass player, better than the guitar player, better than the keyboard player. And that's the situation with David, where like, I'd been wanting to work on his stuff. You know, I've known him for years and been wanting to work on his stuff for a long time. I just never thought he would do it. I just thought, like, he doesn't like to, like, listen to anybody or, you know, he knows exactly what he's doing and he can play everything. So why does he need a producer? However, I felt like, you know, listening to the records, I just, you know, the last few things he did, I remember just thinking, like, I wish I could have, like, a little input into this. And I felt like I had a few concepts that I think would be good for him. And I had, spoken to his manager a little bit and kind of mentioned to him, and he was like, well, why don't we just do a couple of songs and see what happens. And it's like, yeah, perfect. That's generally how I like to work with people, is just like, let's just do one before we commit, and just because I don't want to like get 12 songs into it and then nobody's happy. So we started doing like two songs, maybe, really quick. We laid him down like super quick. He was fast and he wanted to play drums, which I love the way he plays the drums, and that's what I thought we were doing. And then a friend of mine was like, hey, so you're producing David's record? And I'm like, well, we're doing a couple of songs. And he was like, well, he put it on Facebook that you're producing his record. And I was like, oh. So like, I looked it up on Facebook and I was like, oh, I guess I am producing his record. And I talked to his manager and he was like, that's not very David to actually like put it on Facebook, so I guess you are doing his record.
I was gonna say,
that's
a guy that's really not like a Facebook person.
So then suddenly we were working on a record, you know, and he's like, he's super prolific and like,
so just prolific,
a badass. Yeah. While we did our record, he must have done like two on the side, kind of cheating on me. I think he worked on a couple other ones that he just cranked out. But like we had a very specific like kind of theme.
Which record did you do?
I did a Human Tattoo.
Okay.
Yeah, the latest one he put out. Yeah. I mean, he's got a couple other ones, I think, in the can. Oh, thanks. Yeah, he sent me a bunch of demos. He took off to like, you know, do his thing. He went to like Marfa, El Paso, Albuquerque, kind of he roams around there, troubadour style, and just wrote a bunch of songs.
Yeah, he just wrote me Monday from the place, Sonic Ranch.
Yeah. He's in
back. Uncle Tony.
Yeah, exactly.
We worked out there?
We did some of the mixing and we did the mastering out there. It's amazing, man. Amazing spot.
Is it still as cool? Like, I haven't been there in like 10 years.
Yeah.
Still,
I hadn't been there 10 years ago, but it's
still
cool.
Still residences.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. It's pretty rad. So, yeah, he sent me a bunch of songs and a bunch of demos. And what I heard, like, he had sent me some of the stuff he had done, like, in the last few years. And some of it was, like, the kind of really experimental stuff. Some of it was, like, sonically, you know, kind of out there and all of it kind of trippy. But I kind of felt like going back to basics. Where I was like, you know, I like the idea. The songs he was sending me were like super intimate, just acoustic guitar and him. And it was just like, that's what we started with. And he actually kind of, my studio was really small. And he was the one that, you know, I wanted to kind of go do some overdubs and get some piano and stuff. And he was like, well, he was actually the one that was like, why don't we just work with what's in this room? Like sonically to like limit ourselves. He was like, because I could overdub pianos for days. So we were like, oh shit, okay. So I had this idea like that I was hearing through all his songs, like this undercurrent of like, you know, he's kind of like gypsy style. He kind of roams around a lot. And
yeah,
it sounded like the open road to me. Like it sounded like driving through, you know, West Texas, like just kind of sparse. You know, I didn't want to like overdo it on the songs, just kind of sparse, kind of simple. And like have this classic country, like not country, a classic Texas sound, like a, you know, like when you're listening to like Willie Nelson's Redheaded Stranger or something.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of sparse. And it's kind of open and just sounds like the open road. So that was kind of what we went with, you know, took a few turns here and there, but it was pretty awesome to do that one.
What do you, and he's happy with it. I love it. I think it's
cool.
Great. He played a couple of shows at the Cactus.
I did. I was there on the second night.
Okay. I think I was there on the first night.
Yeah.
What a fantastic performer. And then we got to do that. I met you, at the Sims thing for the Elliott Smith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have his set list, his actual set list.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh, he ended it with Everything Means Nothing.
Yeah. That was that tour, the Figure Eight tour.
Crazy.
Tell me about, where did you're from Laredo?
I'm from Laredo, Texas.
You're born there?
Yep.
And you're obviously Spanish.
Mexican, yeah.
Mexican. Yeah. I'm Cuban. I lived in Mexico when I was a kid.
Where exactly did you live?
In Fortín de las Flores, which is cool. In Veracruz.
Crazy.
But inland a bit, in the rainforest. Tell me about growing up down there and what kind of music, how did you get exposed to music? Was your family like music fans? Was
anyone really
a musician?
I mean, they like listened to music. They had, you know, I have my dad's record collection, which was the same shit everybody had in the late 60s, you know, like everything from Santana to
The Doors, Earth, Wind & Fire,
all that stuff that everybody was listening to back then. You know, all the Beatles records, John Lennon, whatever, all that stuff. But in my family wasn't really like musical. My parents worked a lot. I was an only child. I was home by myself all the time. And I just basically, I was an artist. I was actually a visual artist. So like I drew all the time. I was kind of in my own world a lot. And well, like a big thing for me down there, because it's kind of isolated. It's not like a super tiny town. It's like, it's sort of a big city. There's a lot of people there, but it's super isolated. Like everything gets there. You know, everything we were doing when we were like, you know, 13, like being skaters or whatever, was getting there like 3 years after everybody else was skaters. Or riding bikes and punk rock and all that was way late. Like we were like always.
But you got it there? You got punk rock?
Yeah. I was into skate rock.
Okay.
You know, so I wasn't like shaving my head, but I was into like Dead Milkman, Dead Kennedys, all the Misfits, that kind of stuff. Whatever the older skater kids were listening to, because my neighbor was like 3 years older than me, so he always had the cool shit.
All right.
But like a big thing for me, and it sounds like cheesy nowadays, but back then really wasn't, was like MTV. Like I that's how I found out about a lot of music. Like I saw the first day that MTV launched the Rocket and all that. And that's like, because that was, you know, there wasn't shows, there wasn't bands playing, there wasn't like clubs I could go to. Like, I found out a lot of shit through MTV. I watched, like, religiously for, like, the first 3 or 4 years. And then...
Do you know when they started?
I don't remember the exact day, but I saw it.
No. They had 35 videos.
Oh, wow.
And they were going to do this thing for 20... That's like a radio station starting with just 35 totally. Songs.
if we dug up that list, which I'm sure is like on the internet, I bet I know every one of those songs.
Oh, my God. It's crazy. Yeah. Well, it's like Rod Stewart and like weird people that had videos that, mm-hmm. you know... Totally. Sorry, so go ahead. So that influenced you?
Big time. Like, that was where I was like, oh, shit. And then like, that's where I got turned on to like rap music. I was super into hip-hop. And then when like 120 Minutes came out, I found out about all these cool like alternative bands and stuff. And so it was like a major, you know, nowadays it's like MTV just sucks so bad that if you tell somebody like, I liked MTV, it just sounds bad. But back then it was actually like, there was videos and it wasn't like, you know, obviously there was not everything on there was great, but there was a lot of cool stuff. And it was the only way for me to hear music. There was like the radio station sucked down there, you know?
Right, but also from people our age to like people that are coming up now, it's so like we had to wait for things. We had to hear about things and then like, what do you mean there's this thing? No, there's this new video that I heard it's Michael Jackson. It cost $1 million and it's kind of like, are you fucking kidding me? No, yeah, it's like for the song of Thriller. You're kidding me. They made it, no. And so you had to sit there and wait for it to happen. Like there's no... I really try to not say this shit, but like kids today.
Yeah, no, I say that all the time.
You know what I mean? You know Frenchie Smith, right?
Yeah.
He goes, okay, so we had this talk. Like he's from this little town in Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And when he got into music, like that kind of music, he couldn't find those fucking records there. Mm-hmm. He had to make a pilgrimage with his friends like once or twice a month to Dallas to some underground record store. Mm-hmm. It was like if you wanted something, you had to commit to like getting to it. Like if you were a nerd for something, it took a lot of work. It didn't take just looking at your phone and you know everything about it. And me, oh, you know, the Dead Milkmen were blah, 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 you know.
Yeah. Well, that's why people, like, back then we, like, again, it's back to, like, the kids nowadays, but I do have daughters and, like, they can get anything. Like, for example, even, like, this is a ridiculous example, but because of my kids, I have this example. I used to look forward to Saturday mornings so I could watch cartoons. Yeah. Right, I had to wait a week, and I'd wake up, I'd get my fucking cereal, and I'd go and I'd watch all the cartoons, and I knew which one was next, and then it was over, and it was like, oh, fucking Saturday was rad, can't wait till next Saturday. Well, now my daughter wants to watch Yo Gabba Gabba, and it's on demand, and they know how to use the fucking Netflix thing, and they're just like, they want to watch it right now, and they don't understand why. Like, you used to have to wait a week to watch the cartoons because that was like it only happened, and you couldn't. There was no on demand, and like. Couldn't get on YouTube or whatever. And it was the same thing, like especially with like music, but you also had to be creative. Like I remember you know, I was always into like the VCR and and our stereo. My parents would always come home and I'd be taking apart the stereo and doing shit, but like figured out how to connect out of the RCA into my tape deck, and I would record songs off MTV because I wanted to hear them. And I knew, like, for example, like Sunday nights or whenever like the 120 minutes first came out. And then there was Headbangers Ball on Saturday. You know, things like that. I was like, oh, man, I know they're going to play that one video. So I'd, like, be there right there and record it onto a tape and catch it. I'm like, okay, now I can get this. But, like, it took work to do that. You know, it wasn't just, like, sitting there on a computer searching. But, yeah. Kids nowadays, man, I'll tell you.
So what did you started on guitar?
Yeah.
What was the thing that made you go, like, I need a guitar?
Well, my dad wanted, and he's, like I said, he's not, like, a musician. And, I mean, he's into music, but he... for whatever reason, wanted me to play piano, was like really pushing me to play piano. But I was in sixth grade and hanging out with a bunch of dudes, and I'm like, man, piano's gay. Like, I don't want to play piano. I'm so sure. Right. Like, I was a skater, and I was like, so gay. I don't want to play piano.
Yeah.
Nothing against gay people. But no. So I finally was just like, all right, I'll do guitar. And like, guitar is cool, you know.
Yeah,
people in bands play guitar.
You can shred.
But now, man, I'm kicking myself. Like, I just still, like, my dad still messes with me about that. I wish I had played the fucking piano first. Everybody plays guitar. It's like, piano just rules, you know. I mean, I can fiddle, I can get by on chords, but I really wish I'd started at that age. Like, it's such a better instrument to start on. And so I started taking guitar lessons, and I started with classical and flamenco, and then. For like a year or two, but it's like at that age, it's really hard it really takes a lot of patience. And like, I wanted to play rock and roll, you know, so it was like started playing by like, I think 1990, 1991 was like Nirvana and all that. So that's what I started getting into. And then somehow around like 93 or something, I would go through just like serious phases where I'd get obsessed with one thing and then move away and then come back. But, you know, so then I started.
You do that in the developmental times.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you do. You become like, yeah, go ahead.
Then one day it was just like, man, fucking rock sucks. I like hip hop. And then I got into hip hop for 2 years and then I was like, man, hip hop is stupid. Like, I like, suddenly I somehow discovered Lynyrd Skynyrd when I was in high school and I was like, that's cool guitar shit.
Yeah.
And then back to, you know, around 16, 17, we like had a band where we were finally writing original music. And then, you know, from there, it just kind of...
It's interesting because throughout all those styles of music that you talked about, you really gave yourself a pretty broad education.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? In music, which is great. Probably a palette that you still... It started your palette to be a producer.
Yeah, and I think like with the hip-hop thing... I realized later, it wasn't until I was like 18 or 19, but then there's like this whole subculture of DJs at that time that were going and finding all the original records they sampled. And then you could now get that stuff. And then that's when I started realizing, like, that's how I got, you know, still hip hop was probably like one of the biggest influences for me of how I got into soul music and funk music was because of finding out the original records they sampled. Like, oh shit, that was really James Brown.
Yeah.
And then I got into James Brown, and that's, you know, still probably like the thing that was like the most influential for me was because I'm, you know, my favorite music is soul music and funk music and stuff. And it came from that, you know, it was like, I still appreciate the hip hop records for what they were doing back then. Cause it was like serious, like genius to figure out that these kids in the Bronx didn't have a musical education. They didn't have instruments. And like, what else could they do? Like, well, we have our parents' turntables. What if we just took this and hooked up a mic to the fucking street light and have a party?
Yeah.
And you know, like that's pretty genius
yeah.
to do back then, like just making do with what you have.
But that's the same kind of idea that David had when you guys made that record.
Like, yeah.
Let's not go outside of this.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like where there's a will, there's a way. You'll make some something.
Yeah.
You know
yeah.
what I mean?
As like it with that's great. With, you know, as much as I like hang around studios and stuff and do studio work, you know, people are so obsessed with the latest like Pro Tools, whatever. And then I got all the new plugins and I got all the new like rack gear and everything. And it's just like, man, some of my favorite records were done on a 4-track cassette. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just about what you do with it. And if your song sucks, it's going to suck with the new Pro Tools too, you know, or, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, it's really about, I mean, obviously it helps to have like a good recording and stuff, but at the same time, it's like, you know, some of like my favorite stuff that I was into when I was 13, if I hear it now, it kind of sounds like shit. Like those early Dead Milkmen records, they sound like shit, but they were awesome. They were jamming. The songs were cool. And like, who cares how they did it?
So. Yeah. The energy is there. Like Meet the Beatles, obviously fucking, you know, Abbey Road is much more sonically amazing than Meet the Beatles, but there's an energy that's not on Abbey Road that's on Meet the Beatles.
And it translates, like, you yeah, hear totally. It, you're like, oh man,
you get it. Yeah,
yeah, totally.
Yeah, you play it for someone. So do you have a studio at your place?
Yeah.
Do you go to other studios and cut shit?
Yeah, I do, because my studio's small, and I'm actually like about to start building something because I finally feel like I'm at the point where I hate the limitation. Like, I can't have a live band all at once. You know, I could probably fit three. The most I've done live is like three people at once. So I have a small spot, but it's kind of in my house and I have kids, so it's hard. But yeah, I do work out of a lot of other studios, like Stuart Sullivan Studio. He was one of the first studios that I really started working at a lot. And he taught me, you know, just sitting around and watching him. And he's just hysterical. So
yeah,
he was like the 11th member of Grupo back then. Super funny. For somebody to weird out us with like jokes and like creep us out with the jokes, that's how out there he was, you know what I mean? We were like, oh dude, if this dude's jokes are seriously dark or making us feel uncomfortable, then like he's awesome. So because we had some dark humor, but he was like one of the first studios and he like taught me a bunch of shit. And then you know, we couldn't work with him anymore, not because he was overcharging us, we just didn't have any money. And then since then, man, I work at a lot of studios. One of my favorite ones is Big Orange, which is on East 4th. It's really kind of a nondescript spot. It's what's his name? He used to be in Sound Team, Matt.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
What is Matt's last name? I totally know Matt. I'm gonna feel like an asshole for not knowing his last name. Matt. Oh my god, dude! I have to get this name.
That's okay.
He was in a band called Sound Team. Tall guy, and then he's in TV Torso. What Matt is?
What I remember the first time I ever saw sound team, I was so envious of their gear. I'd never seen a band with such great vintage gear.
Like
weird keyboards and stuff. It's almost like those guys could have started a Switched On in that band.
Exactly. Matt Oliver.
Matt Oliver.
He's a good friend of mine. I can't believe I don't remember his last name. Well, I think they were like, and I think the way Matt did it for Big Orange was I think sound team was, you know, like at the tail end of like major label money. They got a big major label deal and they took all their money and bought a bunch of shit. And he, I think, invested in the studio, and that's how he still has it.
Genius.
Did a lot of work at Jim Eno's spot at Public Hi-Fi. Work with Jim a lot. Cacophony Records with Eric Wofford.
Yeah. There's a studio community, even though as a model, the studio is a tough business to be in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how tough is it? You have optimism, though.
It's
tough. You're going to build.
Yeah. The good thing is that I don't have overhead yet. You know, so I don't really know. I'm not really in the league of like a Jim Eno or, you know, like a Public Hi-Fi or something like that, where like they have serious overhead. I mean, like hundreds and hundreds of $1,000s of gear, probably a $700 electrical bill, you know, stuff like that, that I don't have. Cause I, you know, my spot is small, but, you know, and I don't have any intentions to compete on that level. Like I'm not, it's mainly, I want to build a spot for me to work on the things I'm already working on and my own stuff. And that's it, just a more comfortable place. But I'm not going to go buy a vintage Neve console or anything like that. Yeah. If I need to do that, then I'll just call Jim or whatever. Yeah. But so yeah, the studio thing is tough. The good thing is that people make a lot of records here. There's a lot of bands.
Yeah.
And as you know, and not all of them are great, but there's a lot of great bands.
Yeah.
And then also like people from out of town like Austin. We have a good reputation so far.
Do you have some people that come in?
Yeah. I'm actually working with a band. Oh, they just moved down here, but from DC right now, called Bone, Fur, and Feathers. I'm actually mixing with them today. They moved down here from DC. They're old friends of mine from DC, and they totally made the move down here, and they're pretty soon, once they get this record out, hopefully going to start making some noise here, but they're fucking rad. Really cool stuff.
Awesome.
It's kind of like, you remember Mazzy Star?
Yeah.
It's sort of like on that trip, like super slow, like really mellow, trippy, kind of almost with a country feel, like melancholy stuff. Super cool, man. I totally zone out like listening to their stuff all the time.
Do you have a broad taste?
Yeah,
in music.
I think so.
You can speak to the musicians in their language.
Yeah,
if
I think
it changes.
So. I mean,
are you cool in jazz or is that?
Yeah, I went through a heavy jazz phase. My first group here actually in town when I moved here was sort of like poor man's jazz freak out. Punk rock stuff called the Blue Noise Band. It was we did that in 97 through like 99 or 2000. And we used to play with Golden Arm Trio a lot, which is Graham Reynolds. So that was, we were kind of in that trip, like we played like a lot of the punk rock spots. Like we ended up playing the Elephant Room eventually a few times and stuff, but we did that for a few years, and that kind of sort of blended into Grupo.
Three of us
from that band out of four went into Grupo. And I went through like a heavy jazz phase when I moved here. When I was like 18, I got obsessed with it and never really like learned jazz in the proper sense, but we like did our own version of it, just like super rocked out. At the time, I was really into like, a friend of mine was turning me on to like all the kind of underground New York stuff, like John Zorn and Mark Ribot and all that. Uh-huh. And so we got like way into that, just like heavy kind of art rock jazz freak out, where we didn't really play jazz that well, but we played it like it was rock and roll or something.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
Hey, how do people find you? Do you have an adriancasala.com?
I have level1studiosatx.com.
Level1studiosatx.com,
yeah. Okay. Or you could just, if you just search my name, that's what comes up. It's basically my website. Yeah, for some reason, making adriancasala.com felt weird. I just need to do it and make it easier, but.
It is weird. Somebody has my name.
Are you serious?
A label that I was on that put out the last album that I did.
And they still have the name?
Yeah. They still have my name.
Intellectual property, man. Web property.
That's my name.
Yeah, it's
you can't just own
when do you get? How do you get that back?
Well, they keep on saying like, oh yeah, let me send you the stuff. And then I don't hear from them again because I'm trying to get it going.
Yeah. It's pretty weird.
Yeah. Is there anything I'm missing about you? Is there stuff that people should know?
Should know.
They find you places?
I'm out playing or, you know, just like in the last, since I've left Grupo, I've been able to, obviously how I met you, like, just kind of play guitar.
That was fantastic. You know, it was interesting because I didn't know you were you. Same thing with Dana Fackelberry. I thought I had met this girl named Dana.
That's hilarious.
And that she was real nice. And I didn't realize that she was actually Dana Fackelberry, whose music I'd heard. Same thing with you. You were a guy named Adrian that was there.
That was a special gig, man. I don't know if
that... special group of people, too.
Totally. Like, I still think about that gig, and it actually, like, I was into EXO when it came out.
Yeah.
And I heard a little bit of Figure Eight, but around that time, I kind of just stopped listening, and but I was really into EXO, and just, like, I actually made a playlist of all the songs we played to, like, to prepare for that gig, and I still, like, find myself going back and listening to it. And I think that was, like, one of the cooler gigs I had, like, was able to be a part of, like, all of us coming together, and, like, it was really...
Yeah, just the music to, like, the... I mean, to be a singer in that situation and just be able to walk into that cradle, it was... I mean, the foundation was real... It was real easy as a singer to go up and sing, and you guys really made it, you know?
Yeah.
It was weird to see David. Like, he just doesn't not work.
I don't know how he pulled that off. Freaky. That was intense.
Last night, I watched a couple episodes of Friday Night Lights back-to-back on Netflix, and I was just thinking throughout this interview, I was like, I bet David didn't do that last night. But he wasn't like, oh, let's watch this weird high school football TV show drama, soap opera.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's doing something.
Well, it's, yeah, amazing. He's a natural. Like, actually, I'm playing with him at a wedding in Marfa this weekend, heading out tomorrow. But, and I kind of heard through the wedding, through the couple, like, oh, yeah, David's going to have you play on a couple of songs. And I was like, I know him. A couple means like, yeah, brother, just stay up on stage. It's going to be 12, you know? Yeah. And I had to email him, and I was like, can you send me the list of songs? Like, I was like, I'm not a natural. Like, I need to actually practice. Like, yeah, I need to maybe even route the chords on a paper. Like, you know what I mean? I can't just get up. I mean, I could fake it, but I don't like to fake it too much. And I just can't pick up as fast.
That, too, because he thinks that, and not in a bad way, he just kind of thinks everyone's like him sometimes. And
yeah,
you're kinda
totally.
Like, I'm not that advanced.
Yeah, man. So, but that, man, that Elliott Smith gig, I'll tell you, like, that was, it felt like, it was emotional, too, man. Like, I left
Very
and actually
emotional.
had to, like, with his sister there and then meeting his parents
and
reading the lyrics a lot around that time because we were doing the gig, and like, man, I was talking to his parents, I almost like started crying. I was like, man, this is intense shit. Like, and I had to go have some drinks.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't need a reason to go have drinks after a gig, but I needed to decompress, man. It was heavy.
Yeah, that was. I feel like I decompressed a lot backstage after the show.
Yeah, exactly.
I got pretty
drunk.
But it was amazing. It was neat to get to tell that lady what her son's music meant to me, which was good. All right, so if anyone's at this wedding in Marfa this weekend, this is actually coming out tomorrow because I've taken a few weeks off of doing interviews.
Nice.
And so usually I'm working like a month out, but now I'm working next day.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much for coming.
Hey, man,
Adrian.
Thanks for having me. Thanks
and
for
go,
putting up
again.
With me early. Level1StudiosATX.com.
Level1StudiosATX.com.
It's complicated. You could probably just search my name and it comes up. So.
Okay. Adrian Casala. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me, man.
And I look forward to hanging out with you more.
Yeah.
Great Adrian Casala. All right. Love that guy, man. Love having him in here. I'm glad I got to meet him. I think I'd like to work with him at some point. I like what he does. I'm all of a sudden super stopped up. How obnoxious is that? Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget, while you're on the internet out there in internet land, go to iTunes, subscribe to this podcast, leave a comment, leave a rating. It helps us with our ratings on there, which in turns will keep this show free to you, which is what I'm trying to do all the time. Keeping it free for you guys. You want to know what's going on? Go to our Facebook page. How did I get here? You want to know what's going on with me? From time to time, follow me on Instagram. I am at Johnny Gowdy. Follow me on Twitter. I am at Johnny Gowdy. I have not been able to put Instagrams. Listen to my weird phone, because my phone's broken and I've got this loner phone. Shit, man. Let's play some. All right. Well, okay. I went and answered the phone, and now I came back. Through the miracle of recording, I paused it. That was Joseph King. He's coming into town. All right, so we're going to hang out. Hey, everyone, thank you so much for listening. Let's get into the Echocentrics, another of Adrian's bands, one of his many, many bands. And get out there, support music. Do it, all right? And support this podcast. by donating in the donate thing on the How Did I Get Here Podbean website. You can see it over there on the right at the very bottom. Donate money. Give me some money. All right, the Echocentrics, let's get down.